conversation, spoke again before the politician had a chance. He said, "But have you seen her?" Lauderback frowned.
"Who? The girl in the road? The whore? No, not since that evening. Though I did hear that she revived. You think I ought to have paid a call upon her, that's why you asked."
"No, no," said Balfour.
"A man of my station cannot afford—"
"Oh, no, no, you can't afford, of course."
"Which brings us back to the sermon, I suppose," Lauderback said in a newly reflective tone. "That was the clerk's precise point. Until certain measures are in place, almshouses and so forth, convents, then who's accountable in a situation like that? Who's responsible for a girl like her, someone who has no one, in a place like this?"
This was intended as a rhetorical question, but Balfour, to keep the conversation moving, answered it.
"No one's accountable," he said.
"No one?"
Lauderback looked surprised.
"Where's the Christian spirit in you?"
"Anna tried to take her life. To end her life, you know. No one's accountable for that except herself."
"You call her Anna?"
Lauderback said reprovingly.
"You are on first-name terms with the girl. I'd say you have a share of responsibility in caring for her."
"First-name terms didn't light her pipe."
"You would shut your door to her because she's inebriate?"
"I'm not shutting any doors. If I'd found her in the thoroughfare, I'd have done just as you did. Exactly as you did. Saved her life. Turned her in."
Lauderback waved this correction aside.
"But then what?" he said. "A night in the jailhouse. And then what? Who's there to protect her when she lights her pipe all over again?"
"No one can protect a soul against themselves. Against their own hand, you know."
Balfour was vexed. He did not enjoy discussions of this kind. Really, he thought, it was only marginally better than the relative merits of Ship-Rigged and Square. But then Lauderback had been a poor conversationalist this fortnight past. Despotic in tone, by turns evasive and demanding. Balfour had chalked it up to nerves.
"Spiritual comfort, that's what he means. Spiritual protection,"
put in Jock Smith, meaning to be helpful, but Lauderback silenced him with the flat of his hand.
"Forget suicide. That's a separate argument and a morbid one," he said. "Who's there to give her a chance, Thomas? That's my question. Who's there to give that sorry girl one clean shot at a different kind of life?"
Balfour shrugged. "Some folk are dealt a bad hand. But you can't rely on another person's conscience to live the life you want to live. You make do with what you're given. You struggle on."
In which remark, the shipping agent showed his uncharitable bias. The obstinacy that hung as a weighted counterpoint beneath the lively indulgence of his outward air. For like most enterprising souls, he held his freedoms very chary, and desired that all others would do the same. Lauderback sat back and appraised Balfour down the length of his nose.
"She's a whore," he said. "That's what you're saying, isn't it? She's just a whore."
"Don't mistake me, I've got nothing against whores," Balfour said. "But I don't like almshouses, and I don't like convents. They're dreary places."
"You are provoking me, surely," Lauderback said.
"Welfare is the very proof of civilization. It is its finest proof, indeed. If we are to civilize this place, if we are to build roads and bridges, if we are to lay a foundation for the future in this country,
then we may as well give our road builders something to warm their beds at night," Balfour finished for him. "It's hard work shoveling stones."
Jock and Augustus laughed at this, but Lauderback did not smile.
"A whore is a moral affliction, Thomas. You must call a thing by its name," he said. "You must insist upon a standard if you stand at a frontier."
This last was a direct quote from his most recent electoral address.
"A whore is a moral affliction. That's the end of it. A bad drain for good wealth."
"And your remedy," Balfour returned, "is a good drain for good wealth. But it's a drain all the same, and money's money. Leave off the almshouses, and let's not go turning any of our girls into nuns. That would be a damned shame, when they are so outnumbered as it is.
Lauderback snorted.
Outnumbered and outfoxed, I see, he said. Responsibility for halls, said Balfour.
He shook his head.
They'll have a seat in Parliament next.
Augustus Smith made a rude joke in response to this, and they all laughed. When their laughter had subsided, Lauderback said,
Let's not talk in this vein any longer. We have discussed that day from all corners and all sides. It makes me tired.
He indicated with a circular sweep of his hand that he wished to return to their previous conversation.
With respect to the ship rig, my argument is simply that how one conceives of the advantages depends entirely on where one stands. Jock held his perspective as a former able seaman. I held mine as a ship owner and a gentleman. In my mind, I see the sail plan. In his, he sees tar and oakum and the breeze.
Jock Smith responded to this jibe conventionally, but with good cheer, and the argument was revived. Thomas Balfour's irritation was revived just as quickly. He felt that he had spoken wittily on the subject of asylum. Lauderback had praised his rejoinder, and he wished to persist with that topic of conversation in order that he might seize the opportunity to do so again. He did not have anything witty to say about the ship rig and its advantages, and neither, he thought sulkily, did Jock, nor Augustus, nor Lauderback himself. But it was Lauderback's custom to begin and end conversations at whim, changing the subject simply because he had tired of a certain issue, or because his authority had been trumped by another man's. Thrice already that morning, the politician had protested the introduction of a new theme, returning always to his imperious patter about ships. Every time Balfour began to speak of local news, the politician declared himself sick to death of useless brooding about the hermit and the whore, when in fact, Balfour thought with annoyance, they hadn't discussed either event in any real detail, and certainly not from all corners and all sides. This internal expression of feeling followed a pattern, though an unacknowledged one. Balfour's admiration of Lauderback was so vaulting that he preferred to deprecate himself than to criticise Lauderback even privately when the two men disagreed. But deprecation always waits to be disputed, and if the disputation does not come, becomes petulance. Over the past fortnight, Balfour had kept his silence on the subject of Lauderback's encounter with the dead man Crosby Wells, though the circumstances of the hermit's death held a considerable amount of curiosity for him.